From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump says he's dispatching federal agents to Chicago and Albuquerque as part of what the administration is calling a surge of security forces to assist local law enforcement in curbing violent crime. But in announcing the move yesterday, Trump seemed to confirm the suspicions of Democrats, making it clear the deployment is part of his re-election strategy to position himself as the law and order candidate.
America must be a sanctuary for law-abiding citizens, not criminal aliens. My vision for America's cities could not be more different from the lawlessness being pushed by the extreme radical left. While others want to defund, defame, and abolish the police, I want to support and honor our great police.
And then there's the president's response to protest. Oregon's Department of Justice is suing several federal agencies for seizing and detaining protesters without probable cause. And last night, the mayor of Portland was in a crowd tear-gassed by federal agents. The president has called unrest there worse than Afghanistan. The city says it was fine before the federal troops came. Beth Fooey is senior editor for politics at NBC News and MSNBC. Beth, so we've got two kinds of federal intervention here. The move into Chicago and Albuquerque is something called Operation Legend, started in Kansas City earlier this month. The acting Secretary of Homeland Security says this isn't related to the deployment to Portland. So what exactly is the administration saying these federal agents, you know, going to other cities will do?
Well, there's a couple of things going on here. I mean, number one, there is no question that there has been a spike in shootings in a number of cities across the country. Now, we typically do see a spike in shootings and crime in general in the summer, but this has been unprecedented in cities like Chicago, Philadelphia, Milwaukee, New York. We're seeing a lot more shootings than in typically hot summer days, and that can be perhaps traced to the coronavirus, joblessness. People are tense. People are more hair-triggered than they might normally be, given the many sort of calamities that the country is facing. So there are concerns about getting those numbers of shootings down. And perhaps if a mayor believes that federal help could be welcome into the city to help do that, that's one thing. That would be a mayor's prerogative to invite the federal government to help out in some way. The other thing, though, that we're seeing is not just an offer by President Trump to sort of help local police in dealing with the spike in shootings. They are actually just sort of marching into cities unwelcome and appearing to provoke folks who are there protesting. That's more what we've seen in Portland. And now there's no question that some of the folks in Portland are bad actors who are vandalizing and defacing buildings. Most of them are not. Most of them are peaceful. And the appearance of these federal troops, or whatever you want to call them, federal agents in there, many of them not wearing insignia and sort of grabbing people off the street, is causing a lot of consternation and unhappiness there and probably making things worse.
Well, let's stay, though, I want to get to Portland, but let's stay with the fighting crime in cities. We're going to check in Chicago in a minute. The mayor of Kansas City told NPR's Morning Edition he learned of this new surge from someone on Twitter, and he said he'd welcome some help with things like tracking illegal gun sales. He has concerns about this Operation Legend. Let's listen.
And what this is not supposed to be is the operation we've seen in Portland, where they're yanking protesters off the streets, where we have law enforcement, federal law enforcement, that are supplanting our local agents. We don't want some broader mission creep to other broad-based policing activities.
And Beth, the mayor of Portland, as we said, was one of those tear-gassed at a protest last night. He's described the federal agents there as an occupying force. But it's not just Democratic mayors. Here's former United States Secretary of Homeland Security Tom Ridge, a Republican, speaking to radio host Michael Smirkanish.
The department was established to protect America from the ever-present threat of global terrorism. It was not established to be the president's personal militia. It'd be a cold day in hell before I would consent to an unilateral, uninvited intervention in one of my cities.
Beth Fooey, pretty strong. Could this backfire for President Trump politically?
Yeah, and you know, of course, President Trump tweeted criticism of Tom Ridge after he made those comments. So he's fully ready to, you know, do battle even with other Republicans around this effort. It's it It's a very unusual move by, one could say, Republicans, conservatives, who typically don't want to see the long arm of the federal government moving into local cities. And one could only ask what how conservatives might have reacted had President Obama sent federal troops in to, you know, break up a Tea Party gathering or a Second Amendment rally. The consternation would be huge. But President Trump is definitely betting that the optics of seeing cities under siege or seeing cities being violent
will
is
work
going to
for
help him.
We're going to have to leave it at that. Beth Thuy, NBC and MSNBC, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go to Chicago now, where President Trump has said he'll be sending a surge of federal agents as part of that plan to combat violent crime. Chicago's Mayor Lori Lightfoot says she's cautiously open to federal intervention by working with Chicago police to curb the violence. This month so far, more than 300 people have been killed in the city. Earlier this week, Mayor Lightfoot made a point to say she won't allow Chicago to become like Portland.
We can't put anything past the Trump administration. I'm hopeful that they will not be foolish enough to bring that kind of nonsense to Chicago, but I'm also not naive, and we're going to be diligent, and we're going to be ready, and if we need to stop them, we are going to.
For the latest, we're joined by Gregory Pratt, who covers Mayor Lightfoot and City Council for the Chicago Tribune. Gregory, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Gregory, first, what changed for the mayor? Because earlier this week, she was saying this idea of the White House sending agents in was, quote, not something that was going to happen in Chicago.
Well, you know, there's a bit of a nuanced situation happening here, which is part of what can explain some of what the mayor's been talking about, where she's open and has been open to help from the feds insofar as if they send more agents who can work on cases, who can work on investigations into drugs and gangs, which is what drives a lot of the street violence. But she is not in favor of them doing any sort of mission creep or deviating from that. The other thing that changed for her is that she's a former federal prosecutor, and the U.S. attorney here is a former colleague, and she keeps turning to him and saying, well, he's assured me that, you know, it's under control and I trust him.
And when you say creep, I mean, that is the big question. Will these agents be coming in to help and combat the ongoing violence, or are they going to be focused on BLM protesters?
Well, you know, the mayor's office and the mayor are pretty clear that they are here to be working with police on violent crime, not anything to do with protesters. And she has said that if they do that, she will take whatever action she can, which it's unclear what power she actually does have to stop that. But she said she will oppose it vigorously.
Have you heard any word on the timeline, how long they're expected to be in the city? Is this a finite amount of time, or are we talking about some sort of agreement that kind of really takes this on in a way that might take many years?
I don't think this is forever. If I recall correctly, there is a time frame of maybe a couple months, but I'm not sure how long they're going to be here.
As I mentioned, Chicago is experiencing an increase in violence. The number of shooting victims is up 50% from last year. And it's really not just Chicago. In New York, too, shooting victims are up 77% from this time last year. A representative, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, is actually drawing this connection to the hardships people are facing because of the pandemic, to the wave of violence. But Chicago has had an ongoing problem for many years. What's your sense of what's driving this current violent surge in Chicago?
Well, it's anybody who ever tells you that they can explain Chicago violence is lying, because it's this really complicated thing where you have generational poverty, a lot of gangs, a lot of disinvestment in neighborhoods. There's so many problems that go into this. Traditionally, you know, a lot of what does drive it is gangs and gang conflict, and some of the gang conflicts have heated up. There's, you know, I've heard and seen some of the talk that perhaps the coronavirus and people being more unemployed have been affected by that. But crime was already up, so I don't necessarily know if that's true. But it's this incredibly complicated situation. But we do have a lot of gangs, and right now they are beefing.
Mayor Lightfoot's decision to work with federal authorities comes at a time when so many Black Lives Matter activists and sympathizers are calling on cities to defund the police. How are Chicagoans responding to her decision?
Well, you know, there's a lot of concern, especially from activists. And the activists are already at odds with Mayor Lightfoot because she's not in favor of defunding police, period. She's very much a law and order person and a prosecutor. That's not to say she wants to shut down protests and things like that, but the mayor's a former federal prosecutor who makes public safety one of her top priorities every day. She is not the mayor of Minneapolis talking about how they're going to take the city police department down and rebuild it. You know, she wants to do more incremental type of reforms and work to change the accountability structures. So she's walking a pretty fine line where she is both pro-police and anti-bad police. And that doesn't really satisfy anybody because the FOP's mad at her and so are the activists.
That's Gregory Pratt, reporter for the Chicago Tribune. Gregory, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Bard College at Simon's Rock, where students who crave intellectual freedom can begin college after the 10th or 11th grade. Bard College at Simon's Rock unleashes students' curiosity through a rigorous liberal arts and sciences curriculum and puts them on track toward completing a bachelor's degree 1 or 2 years early. Now accepting applications for fall 2020. simons-rock.edu/now, where independent minds get their start.
Another grim day when it comes to the coronavirus. The U.S. recorded 1,000 deaths from COVID-19 in a single day for the first time in 2 weeks. As the country inches towards 4 million infections, that's a quarter of the world's cases. And there are new records. California recorded 12,807 new cases in a single day. In Texas, a new record for single-day deaths with close to 200. And in Florida's Miami-Dade County, ICU admissions are up to 130% of capacity. The county has over 92,000 cases. That's 7,000 more cases than all of China. So let's bring in infectious disease specialist Dr. Eileen Marty. She's a professor at Florida International University. She's been called Florida's Anthony Fauci. She joined us by Skype. So, Dr. Marty, Florida had some restrictions early on. Then we all saw people partying, going to beaches, graduations, anti-mask rallies. The rates have shot up. And there are new, harsher restrictions. Tell us about those.
We've walked back some of the things that we had opened up. We disallowed mass gatherings on July 4th. We closed the beaches again. We started a curfew. Now on Miami Beach, the curfew is at 8 o'clock, and it took over a month to get civil penalties for not adhering to new normal guidelines. And actually, that was pretty fast for the way the government normally works.
Okay, so you've got these restrictions in place now. You've got some penalties. But late yesterday, your governor, Ron DeSantis, said that parents should have the option of sending their kids back to school. Earlier, there'd been a requirement from the state that the schools open. There was a lot of pushback on that. Now he seems to be pivoting a bit, saying parents should have the option. But that still means that all the schools physically have to open, just in case some parents in that school want to send their kids back. You think this is really going to happen? The fall is only a couple months away.
When we look at the order that came down from Tallahassee, it does have a little note of freedom in that it allows a county, based on its health conditions, they can elect not to have face-to-face classrooms of any kind. And that's what our superintendent, Carvalho, who is phenomenal, and he gathered early on a group of physicians, myself included, to analyze and come up with ways in which we could have face-to-face schooling at any kind. And this was back when our numbers were low. Even then, almost 30% of parents preferred to have strictly online learning when the schools opened up. And Superintendent Carvalho is wanting to follow the science. He wants to see a sustained positive rate in our community of under 10%, trending towards 5% for at least 14 days, with a goal of 3% before he would consider having face-to-face classrooms. And then okay. He has, in fact, seven other criteria: a steady reduction in the number of people hospitalized for respiratory influenza-like symptoms or COVID symptoms, a sustained reduction in ICU bed occupancy, none of which, of course, is happening right now, a continuous reduced community viral burden, and an increase in availability of COVID-19 RNA testing for the virus itself, not antibody. Also, a decreased response time for the test results, 48 hours or less. And also an increase in the quantity and quality of contact tracing. And last but not least, we want to see an increased number of general vaccinations for school-aged children, because we've had a drop during this COVID lockdowns and so forth in parents taking their children for their regular vaccines.
Right. I mean, you have concerns beyond COVID-19. You have concerns that kids haven't been getting vaccinated for other illnesses. Well, that's an amazing list of things that your superintendent there is hoping to have before school comes back. That's just in a few weeks. I mean, given that you're in this crisis now, do you think that's realistic?
No. Now, certain types of children, for example, we've had ongoing daycare for, you know, parents, for example, healthcare working parents, right, that absolutely need some way of being supported. These have been very, very strictly monitored, and it's a situation different than your typical school. But no, unless we can meet these criteria, we will not be seeing face-to-face classrooms.
Well, I just want you to comment on President Trump's comments last night about children and his claim that they can't transmit the coronavirus. Let's listen.
So they do say that they don't transmit very easily, and a lot of people are saying they don't transmit, and we're looking at that. We're studying, John, very hard, that particular subject, that they don't bring it home with them. Now, they don't catch it easily, they don't bring it home easily, and if they do catch it, they get better fast. We're looking at that fact. That is a factor, and we're looking at that.
And doctor, strongly. We're hearing from studies that say that children 10 and up transmit just as easily as adults do.
Yes, they do. And so there's a lot of very interesting research going on with children right now, such as the one you're citing that came out from the CDC a few days ago, that definitely shows that children above 10 definitely transmit at the same rates as adults. But there's also viral load studies that have been done by a number of labs. And the best one, in my opinion, is Christian Dorsten's lab. And what they did was they sampled children of all ages and adults and tried to estimate the amount of viral load that these different individuals have. And they showed unequivocally that children acquire the virus at equal rates, and that they carry the same amount in their upper respiratory tract as anybody else, and therefore are perfectly capable of transmitting the virus to everybody else, especially children above the age of 10.
I want to talk to you briefly about vaccines, because we know Moderna is holding some of its trials in Florida. The administration announcing an agreement with Pfizer for 100 million doses of their vaccine when it's ready. Just briefly, your thought on where we are on when we might see a vaccine.
So here's the problem. The problem with having a vaccine is that in order to really understand how long the immunity lasts, you have to wait a period of time. You're not going to know that something that produces neutralizing antibodies in 2 months is going to still produce neutralizing antibodies in 6 months or a year. Same with side effects. There are some side effects that don't manifest for 6 months or a year. So every time that we try and pre-anticipate as to when this will be ready, yes, we may have X amount of boluses of drugs ready because we're spending that kind of money by BARDA. That doesn't mean that we're actually going to have something that's proven to be long-lasting, right? And that literally takes time and completely safe.
Sometimes a vaccine can take a decade. And this is why there are people saying, you know, in a recent poll, 35% of Americans say they wouldn't take a vaccine the moment it's released. Another 22% say they're not sure. So maybe some problems looming there. But I also want to ask you about the new study this week in the Journal of the American Medical Association that says the actual number of COVID-19 cases in the U.S. might be 6 to 24% higher than the number of confirmed. You know, what's the, obviously that's chilling, but how further chilling is it to an epidemiologist like you?
That's a really important study. It's part of three different types of CDC surveillance studies going on right now throughout the United States. So the limitations are, number one, the study is not necessarily a random sample of the population. It's people who've had their blood drawn for a particular reason, and we don't know what the reason is the way the study is designed. And number two, ELISA tests that they used has the possibility of, in small amounts, picking up other types of coronaviruses that normally circulate. So even though it is sensitive and specific, there is a little bit in that area of specificity that isn't as high as we wish it were.
So you're saying that this may be flawed, that, you know, maybe it's not 6 to 24% higher, but I guess it's high enough, right? Right now, especially where you are there in, yeah, where you are in Florida. Do you have faith that we can get a hold of this?
Well, other communities in other parts of the world have managed to do it. One of the biggest problems we've had in the United States is we haven't had a whole of government approach and providing that sense of this is true, everyone needs to cooperate to our entire community. And that's really been a huge hamper. So can we get it under control? Could, if we can get the entire population, or at least 99% of us, to cooperate with new normal guidelines. We always have to remember that it always has to be a comprehensive approach. It's never one thing, right? We have to do testing in an appropriate national strategic way so that we truly isolate anyone who's positive and quarantine the closest contacts who may be negative or may not have been tested, so that testing informs contact tracing and contact tracing in turn informs testing. But it would only work if we have enough testing and that that turnaround time for the testing is very short, at worst within 48 hours. And that's not where we are. So that's part of it. So you need a comprehensive approach that includes all the measures that each individual has to do, that each community has to do, and understanding by the community, plus having appropriate contact tracing and testing. That would work.
That's Florida International University infectious disease specialist Eileen Marty on the latest in the coronavirus pandemic, especially there in hard-hit Miami-Dade. Dr. Marty, Eileen, thank you for your time, and thank you so much for your work. Best of luck to you.
Pleasure.
We're now starting to see how the rollback of states reopening is affecting people's ability to get back to work. For the first time in nearly 4 months, the number of Americans filing for unemployment rose last week to 1.4 million. The increase in filings from the week before is at about 100,000. And for more on this, let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC contributor and economics correspondent. And Ali, is this increase primarily because of the surge in cases in so many states?
Yeah, it's the surge in cases that have resulted in companies shutting down again, some states moving backward on their phased opening. There's also another issue, and that is that the funds for emergency federal loans through the Paycheck Protection Program, the PPP, are starting to run out. The program was extended to August 8th, but if you'll recall, many small businesses drew their loans as soon as the program became available in May and June. So there's that. And then hiring has also slowed because there's greater uncertainty about what reopening looks like. So there are still roughly about 32 million people receiving unemployment insurance, and there are 5.4 million posted job openings in the United States. So you can see where that imbalance is.
Yeah, we're also now starting to see the state-by-state picture, and those numbers fell somewhat in the latest report. But how does the dysfunction of the unemployment systems play into the numbers that we're seeing? For instance, all of the people who couldn't file for months because they actually just couldn't get through.
Yeah, and we're seeing it, by the way, we're still seeing this in a number of states. In Oklahoma, we had lineups the other day that looked like you might have been looking at video from the Depression, except it was in color. The states are very, they're in different places in what how their technology works, but in some of these states, it is very, very hard from a computer's perspective just to keep up with this system. And some of them have really onerous requirements. So we now are in the 18th week in which initial claims top 1 million people per week. And those people all have to claim unemployment insurance through their states. There's a federal top-up that's almost $600 a week. Mm-hmm. That's coming to an end this week as well. So the combination of the amount of money that's running out and the fact that it still remains very, very hard to apply for and maintain unemployment insurance is complicating this. There are a lot of people saying, could we just make this system easier in this particular instance? For normal times, unemployment, state unemployment computer systems can handle it. They can't handle this right now.
I mean, let's talk a little bit more about that $600 in relief. As you said, that it's coming to an end this week. Congress is now debating this relief package. This is really important for the overall economy, a decision, but specifically the $600 payment.
Yeah, it's a big issue. The Democrats have passed something called the HEROES Act. That's been passed for a while. It hasn't gone through the Senate because Republicans are sort of arguing amongst themselves and with the White House. There are some people who don't want more benefits going out. They think enough is enough. The debt is increasing as a result. There are others who are saying, well, we do need to increase the amount of the federal supplement to unemployment insurance, amongst other things. But they're looking at a $100 a week increase versus $600 a week. So at $600 a week, you were getting $2,400 a month. Now we're looking at $400 a month. So a $2,000 drop in what people were receiving. And remember, the other thing that happens this week, if Congress doesn't fix it, is that the moratorium on rent and mortgage foreclosures ends.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC, contributor and economics correspondent. Thank you.
Thanks, Anya.
Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler was sprayed with tear gas last night after joining a crowd of protesters. They've continued to show up in the streets for nearly 2 months now, undeterred by the increased use of force by federal officers using unmarked vehicles to detain people. The state of Oregon is now seeking a restraining order against those federal agents. One group out there is now gaining attention for their actions and lullabies. They call themselves the Wall of Moms.
Hands up, please don't shoot me. Hands up, please don't shoot me.
Bev Barnum is one of the organizers behind Wall of Moms, and she joins us now from Portland. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And I want to point out that your voice is actually hoarse because you've been out at the protests. I want to ask you about your motivation. In a matter of days, you and your group have not only joined the protesters, you've also become a focal point. What's been the motivation to join these protests?
The motivation to join the protest was essentially the violation of human rights. There was a viral video, I'm sure you've seen it, two federal officers apprehending a protester with his hands up, moving backwards away from them. They grabbed him, put him in a minivan, and drove off. And that was the catalyst. It really was the moment. And what's keeping us there is learning how to serve the Black community. I would like you to know that we as Wall of Moms, we don't go there with plans of leadership. We don't tell the Black Lives Matter movement what to do or how to do. In fact, it's just the opposite. When we arrive, they tell us how best we can be used. If they want one Wall of Moms, they get one. If they want two, they get two. If they tell us to jump, we jump. And if they tell us to leave, we leave.
Hmm. Were you an activist before the death of George Floyd and what you've been seeing out in the streets in Portland?
No. I regret to say that that I was so stuck in my own little world.
You were called to it based on what you've been seeing.
Now that I have a voice and moms are talking to me, they share the same story. We're here in the suburbs. We're so focused on serving our families that sometimes we forget that the entire world is our family. And as mothers, we have a responsibility to look up and pay attention and do something, just as we would if we were at a lake and a child was drowning or a mother was drowning or a dad. We would jump in and try to save that person. Or if someone falls off their bike, we run and we help them. It's no different. Mm-hmm. What's happening now is no different. We as mothers, we have a responsibility to stand up and help protect human rights.
You make a point to say, though, that your group is following the direction of Black leaders. What has been the reaction to your presence and the chanting?
Thus far, it's been an incredibly positive experience with the Black community. When we do arrive, it's always the same. Thank God the moms are here. I would like to tell you that it is an easy process, that there are no imperfections. But the truth is that most nights we're hustling to listen to as many Black leaders as possible to serve them better. As far as the chanting, we don't create the chants. We follow the chants. Whatever chant is created, we just pick it up.
How did the chant come to be the lullaby? I think that's what so many people are struck by.
That was so beautiful. In fact, it was so organic that we had to sing it over, I think, three times because we didn't know the words. Whoever led that one, they started it. It was the We Shall Overcome. And it turns out, most of us don't actually know the entire verse.
Right, it's part of the canon for Black America. Yeah, it's a common one that many Black Americans know, but really it's not sung by white Americans as much. So you had to learn it while you were out there.
Yes, yes, exactly. And we brought out our phones to act as candles to set the mood. And boy, did it set the mood. After that, we were invited to march. The leader with the microphone said, "Hey, how do you guys feel about marching now?" And we were so empowered to do that. And the leader of that evening said, "Hey, moms, do you want to be up front and protect us again?" And so the moms were up front and we led that march.
As you mentioned, mothers are always there as protectors and to come into action. We've also seen the creation of the Mothers of the Movement, which includes the mothers of Trayvon Martin and Eric Gardner. And now other mothers are really inspired by your actions in Portland.
Yes.
Can you tell me why you think motherhood is such a potent way of leveraging protest?
I think in society, mothers are the ones that hold up families. And I know dads do this too, but I'm telling you, as soon as you become a mom, something primal inside of you just lights up. And all of a sudden, the world isn't this peachy, keen place. Like, you know deep inside that you have to protect it, that you have to protect people. And I feel that's one reason why this movement has caught fire, especially in suburbia. And I also want to say that for Black leaders and everyone else out there, just knowing that mothers care enough to put themselves in front of bean backgrounds and tear gas and rubber bullets and whatever else they throw, it means so much to them, because finally we have some skin in the game for them. Finally, we're standing up. It's too easy to start a GoFundMe for a movement and then get back to your normal life. It's a lot harder to get up knowing that you were just shot and you're going to do it again the next night, because they've been enduring that for God knows how long.
You've been ignited to be a part of this protest and to use your power to amplify anti-racism and really a push for action. What do you want to see happen in Portland and really the nation, and what's next for this movement that you've organized?
I think last night I saw a blip of what I hope to see for the Black community, and that was when our mayor, Ted Wheeler, came out. The Black community asked him questions. It was a question and answer, and his answers were so soft. You know, like, I think it's important to recognize that our mayor is the boss of the PPB, the Portland Police Bureau.
I was happy to see him. And I was certain that there was this fire in him where he was ready to condemn the actions of not only the federal officers, but of the PPB. And that's not what we saw. And so, unfortunately, it caused a rift last night within Black leadership. It really did. And I'm kind of angry this morning at Ted Wheeler for not being a stronger leader. And I'm more angry with him because he didn't stay through the whole night.
He left after he was sprayed with tear gas. Right. What I'm hearing from you is that what you want to see is stronger leadership.
From him, yes. From the people with real power. The people that call the shots. Yes. I want them to use their power, their voice, the media, and condemn the actions of the PPB. Not to hide behind this veil of, oh, I don't really have that much control. I have control in paper. But not in reality. Well, then work to actively change that so that your mothers and your grandmothers and your doctors and your librarians aren't getting shot at in an effort to allow the Black community to advocate for themselves, because it hurts. It physically hurts.
What's next for you, Bev?
Well, I'm awake. We are going to try to figure out if we can reach out directly to Black leaders today. While we're not the mayor and our voice isn't as powerful as him and we don't call the shots, we're gonna stay and protect those kids.
That's Bev Barnum, one of the organizers behind Wall of Moms. This is Here and Now.
Layla?
Yeah?
Nando's is closed as well.
Maybe you've seen the videos of little kids like this girl in England having a meltdown because the pandemic has closed down all their favorite restaurants.
You've literally got to eat mummy's cooking now. I'm so sorry.
Aw, my personal favorite is an American girl in despair because she can't go to McDonald's or places where they have toys and candy. The videos are funny, but it's heartbreaking to see little ones in this deep despair that may also reflect fear about parents' jobs, a pandemic, protests. While educators worry about kids' physical health when schools open, our next guest asks, what about their mental health? Dr. Miriam Jernigan-Nwesi is a psychologist, a teacher at Agnes Scott College in Decatur, Georgia. Dr. Jernigan-Nwesi, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
What can parents do with this kind of despair now?
It's really about being patient, listening to them, encouraging them to express themselves. In the moment, a child may want to start crying. But in addition to that, I think maybe offering arts and crafts, or especially for younger children, they tend to communicate through their play. So you might read them books or encourage them to play and to really talk about how it is that they're feeling. That would be something that's really important in terms of monitoring and then also responding to your child's mental health.
Well, and that's what I loved about the video. The parents just let her go on. No candy or toys. Really quite something, but they let her do it. But now, you know, everybody's saying that it'll be better for the mental health of children if they can get back to what's seen as normal schools.
In the midst of a pandemic, the other thing to remember is that children may be returning to school with some uncertainty about whether or not they will have to leave school again. So while schools have often served as a source of support and stability, we're in the middle of a time where we can't guarantee, right, that students who may be returning to in-person learning won't have to then return home for a period of time if there is, in fact, you know, a second wave. They are, you know, coming back to school feeling very unstable. This place that was once, you know, a place of stability, they've been detached from that, which has affected their own attachment to both their educators and the school environment. And so it's not, I think, guaranteed that students will then, you know, sort of rush back into the school. It will be normal for them, and that will then solve all of the issues or mental health concerns that certainly I'm thinking about as a licensed psychologist. There will also be adults in the building who may also, you know, experience some anxiety. They may have, you know, children of their own. So the stability that once was, I think it's important as we think about the pandemic as being unprecedented, that applies.
What do you have some specifics? I mean, in Massachusetts, there are schools that have programs just for kids who have been through trauma. So when they come back,
Yes. They
have mental health help.
Absolutely. I think we can learn a lot from the trauma-informed lens. The trauma-informed school really looks at how do we create and cultivate an environment. One of the tools, for example, that trauma-informed providers use is calming. Trauma can lead to experiences of disorganization, something we refer to, you know, as our executive functioning in our brains, which allows us to focus and to organize things that that children need for learning. It's about creating or facilitating, right, a way for children to be able to calm themselves. So mindfulness, for example, which is deep breathing. What would it mean to just begin the school day, to take a deep breath, to teach children how to really notice what they are feeling in their bodies, to really enhance their emotional intelligence? I've been really concerned about commentary that says, you know, children have missed so much, we've got to get back to the business of learning. The tools children need to learn may be disrupted at this time.
Well, it's interesting. Some studies have come out. I think one from MIT, concluding that, in fact, when kids go back to school, the schools should lean on the arts, music and art, mm-hmm. not prepare them for tests. But you said something else which is interesting. It just really struck me. Oh, you know, a breathing exercise. Maybe everybody sits around in a circle and breathes deeply. And I find that's so interesting, considering kids mm-hmm. have been hearing, you know, yeah. both people are sick and they can't breathe, mm-hmm. and a man said, I can't breathe. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is what they're carrying with them.
Right. So how do teachers, for example, talk to younger children? I, Robin, have a four-year-old myself. My life partner, before nap time, in an effort to get him to calm down, doesn't say we're going to do deep breathing exercises, for example. What he says is, you know, let's calm ourselves. Let's pretend that there's a birdie on your belly. If you can lie down, you know, on your blankie on the mm-hmm. floor and really breathe in and let that birdie rise, right? And then let the birdie come back down.
Quick question. Should they ask little kids in a circle, what has it been like for you? Or might that be too painful for some kids if, in fact, they know that their dad lost or mom lost a job mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. they lost a relative to COVID, you know, or they're afraid. Maybe they were afraid to go back to school, afraid they're going to catch the I mean, they've been told
sure.
they can't go out.
I think children are honest, right? We sort of point to the videos that you referenced earlier. I would want to gauge. I would not expect all of my students to be able to contribute, but I certainly wouldn't want to deny them an opportunity to really speak about things that maybe they've noticed and haven't had anyone else to talk about. And if I'm noticing that there's a child that is, you know, seems more distressed, I might reach out to school counselor and I might ask my student if they'd like maybe a time to check in with me.
Dr. Miriam Jernigan-Nowessi, psychology professor at Agnes Scott College in Decatur, Georgia. Doctor, thank you.
Thank you for having me, Robin.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.
As pressure builds for Congress to help millions of unemployed Americans, we are listening to your frustrations and taking on your questions.
I would like to know when and how long it takes to get back pay, because we have just been kind of scraping by.
An unemployment expert has some answers next time on Here and Now.